is the Icon Podcast, a community of trained readers reflecting Jesus with Michael Burns and Jason Alexander is back this week. And I'm your host, Gianna Hearn. Jason, what's up? You're back. Good to have you.
What's happening?
What's happening?
I'm back.
I like that.
I was back home. Is it home? I don't know where my home is. But
Wisconsin's always home.
Wisconsin is always home?
Yeah.
Yeah. I think that's fair. Yeah.
All right. Were you just hanging out there, working?
Yeah. No, not working. No. Family, friends, autumn leaves. Break from the heat.
Okay. And Michael, he was in Atlanta last week. So now you both are back at your home base.
That's correct.
Yeah.
Michael, anything to share with us? What's happened in your world?
Well, I want to actually share some big news about Jason.
What?
Yes, Jason this week has become a Sasquatch believer.
That's not true.
It is true, and I'm going to tell you why it's true. Because Jason has always played the role of skeptic because there was no video or pictorial evidence of Sasquatch. Well, guess what? Guess what happened this week?
I don't know.
Footage has come out from people in rural Colorado on a train, middle of nowhere, videotaped what looks like it could be nothing else other than a Sasquatch walking, and then he squats down, presumably to do his business, in the middle of this wilderness, and it's on video. And so now that there's irrefutable video evidence, Jason has no other choice but to believe that Sasquatch
exists. No, I'm looking at it right now.
So am I.
It is 1,000% fake.
It's not fake.
That is the fakest thing I've ever seen. That is like from Spirit Halloween store.
No, nobody even
right. Someone wore a costume and then went out there and said, just film me.
And then just stood in the middle of nowhere hoping that a train might randomly come by and
how do we know they're on a train? It's moving super slow.
This is probably
because the people
drone
that posted
footage.
It said we were on a train. And you can hear in the original footage, you can hear the people talking on the train. And they're filming and they're like, whoa, what is that?
It couldn't be plausible that this person dressed up and knows that a train goes by this area every day. And they're like, oh, I'm going to do this prank and I'm going to dress up and walk in the wilderness as the train goes by.
See, I think Jesus talked about people like you. Like you could see a sign and just not believe. You could be right there.
100% don't believe.
I want to believe. I am open.
You look this up. There's fake. The video. I sent you guys a clip of the one where they expand it and they zoom in.
I'm looking at
you
it.
You can mm-hmm. see it. You
yes,
can see
we're
it.
We're watching it.
It's
you can't see enough detail. But also, I don't believe anything till I go up or someone goes up close enough where you can see like exactly what the fur feels like.
Well, granted, we need biological evidence to support a biological claim, but this is pretty good.
I think what you should do is post this, Michael, because I want our listeners to be able to say, this is fake, because you know they're not looking at what we're looking at here. So we'll post it on Facebook.
I'll say it's scary.
Silverton, Colorado Sasquatch.
It's really creepy. Like if I was on that train, I would shriek.
Oh, if I was on that train, I would pull the stop cord and jump out.
Oh, no
Michael
way.
Michael be in an action movie.
I would absolutely chase a Sasquatch. Like, I would.
I just wouldn't care. I'm like, this is so fake.
You wouldn't care?
No, I wouldn't care. Because even if they are real, we've gotten into this conversation. They're minding their business. They aren't doing anything.
He was evidently doing his business is what it looks like.
That is Fred Gwynn in a bear costume.
Fred Gwynn that played Herman Munster?
Yeah, it's just a tall person in a bear costume.
That's so that's not plausible. We got to apply Occam's razor here. What's the simplest explanation?
I'm using Occam's razor.
I don't think you are. You're making it very complicated.
You know, I'm sure our listeners are so happy that News with Squatch came back in some form today, but we have to move on. We have to move on.
I should have done our theme music, but.
Oh, yeah. Missed that. Well, we have a hard out today. Jason's got business to do, so we got to move on.
He big timed us. He did. Yeah, we have to get moving.
I wish that was true. I have a doctor appointment. That's really big time. Yeah.
Taking care of your health. We like it. We love it. Michael, where are we at now? Because where do we end? And does that have anything to do with what we're doing today?
No. Not specifically, other than that it's all in Revelation, but we had talked about moving on to the concept of the day of the Lord, or I suppose if you're Irish, it would be the day of the Lord.
I'm not Irish.
Well.
Actually, my 23andMe, I think, had a little bit of Irish in it, but we'll move on.
I'm not Irish at all. I'm completely Scottish. It's all I claim.
So the day of the Lord.
Yes.
The day of the Lord. Jason, what do you know about that right off the top? Like, what's the easiest thing you could tell us about that?
just really quick.
yes.
It's good for many, and it's bad for many. It's something you desire and don't want, depending on where you are, I guess, in life. I don't know.
That's fair. That's fair.
It's come. It's here and it's coming. I don't know. It's like a big.
Love it.
Subject. Yeah.
All right. With that, Michael, tell us a little bit more.
Well, it is a big subject and we're going to try to distill it down into just a few minutes ridiculously. And then at the end, Jason is going to provide a specific prediction for the date of the day of the Lord. And so everybody will know when the end of the world is coming.
Yep. So keep listening. Don't turn your calendars off.
That's right. You get your calendars out. No, that would go against everything we've said to this point about the book of Revelation. And yet, it continues to happen. I continue to see, and especially, oh my goodness, has it gotten ramped up lately with the tragedy going on in Israel, and immediately
you're seeing that, Like on social media?
Oh yeah, the calendar thumpers are out, and they are... Oh, this is prophecy, and this is, you know, even though before 1948, when the secular nation of Israel was formed, which really has no correlation to the covenant nation of Israel in the Old Testament, nobody was predicting that Israel had anything to do with, you know, the so-called end times or whatever. That's all relatively new. Ideas and it goes against, as we talked already about the whole, you know, the biblical thing, you won't know the day or the hour. Don't try to do that. But I've seen people posting videos, they're getting into it. They're astronomers now, and they're like, oh, the blood moon and this star and this constellation, and that all means this. And so we'll talk a little bit about today, like that's not, I think, at all what Revelation is trying to get at, you know? So if we start out in Revelation 6, which is where we want to start out today, I'll just summarize. So the seals begin to open. It says the Lamb begins to open the seals. And in Revelation 6, we have this description of the four horsemen, right? The famous four horsemen of the apocalypse. And each horse is depicted as something calamitous. The white horse is conquest, the red horse is death and sword. The black horse depicts economic ruin, and the pale horse is sword, famine, plague, all that stuff. In other words, chaos has hit the land. And again, it's that idea we've talked about, that all the things that empire promises it can provide for us, peace, comfort, security, economic stability, will in fact implode on empire. And we'll talk in a minute of why that is. But this comes to a head, this language, and I think it's important for us to look at this language. Starting in verse 12 of chapter 6, I watched as he opened the sixth seal. There was a great earthquake. The sun turned black like sackcloth made of goat hair. The whole moon turned blood red. And the stars in the sky fell to the earth as figs drop from a fig tree when shaken by a strong wind. The heavens receded like a scroll being rolled up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. So we get this picture of cosmic chaos, earthly chaos, geographic chaos, earthquakes, all of that. Then the kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, and everyone else, both slave and free, hid in caves and among the rocks of the mountains. They called to the mountains and the rocks, "Fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can withstand it?" So that idea of the great day is a specific thing we find in Scripture. Sometimes it's referred to as that day or on that day. You see that phrase a lot in the Old Testament. Or sometimes specifically the day of the Lord. And what it goes back to, it has its roots in many respects in the book of Exodus, where you see the empire of Egypt and, you know, God comes in and he challenges empire. He promises the people of Israel, "I will always oppose empire," the empires that set themselves up as divine, as having the right to determine good and evil, to set themselves in the place of God. Rather than being image bearers, these empires become the place of God and right and wrong and power and all of that. And so God will always challenge that. He will challenge those that set themselves up against God. And you see that in Exodus, God takes on Egypt as empire. And one of the big ways he does that in Exodus is the plagues. And note, we will see a lot of plague language in Revelation, because Revelation is pointing to it. You know, just like God opposed empire there, this is what he's doing again. This is kind of that remix of what he's doing. If you remember the episode where Jason talked about sampling and remixing and taking what was old and kind of describing it in new creative ways. And so in Exodus 12:12, it says, "On that same night, I will pass through Egypt and strike down every firstborn of both people and animals, and I will bring judgment on all the gods of Egypt. I am the Lord." So the plagues, I used to love teaching on this way back in the day, that each plague is, I believe, a statement directly at a specific Egyptian god. It goes right in the face and punches the nose of each Egyptian god. And so God challenges empire on that day. And notice that in Exodus 14, this was a specific event where God went after empire and judged them. And in Exodus 14:30, It says, that day the Lord saved Israel from the hands of the Egyptians, and Israel saw the Egyptians lying dead on the shore. And they would go on to memorialize that day in the Passover. That's kind of what it would remember, was this singular event where God did, I think, three important things. He, God judged self-exalting empires. He liberates people who are being crushed by empire, and he shows himself as the real king. So that three patterns, they look back to this day where God judged empire, liberated people, showed himself as king. And so in the Old Testament, we see Egypt as an archetype of empire, Babylon is an archetype of empire. And now in John's day, he's looking at Rome as another Egypt, another Babylon. And the message here is that God will always oppose empires that refuse to submit to image bearing. He will always, and those three elements, by the way, we see a pattern with the day of the Lord, is always expressed through this cosmic imagery. You'll see basically the same language. You'll see empire, you'll see moon turning to blood, stars falling, all that kind of language will be language of the day of the Lord. And we'll look at this in just a minute, but I want to say, I think this is because empires, and this is to me one of the key messages of Revelation, is that empires are built on power. Power has no place in image bearing. Now, I'm not talking about authority. That's a different thing. You can still have roles of authority in that and image bearing, but it's power under. But as soon as you have power over others that oppresses, that creates levels and hierarchies and status, it's opposite to image bearing. And so empires always operate. Their very lifeblood is opposed to the way God made humanity to function, which is as image bearers. And so you see some elements develop in empire. And I'm not just talking about nations, by the way. Corporations can operate as empire. HOAs can operate like an empire. Churches can operate, unfortunately, like empires. And that's not to say, oh, just forget church. Don't go to church. Leave church, because I don't believe that. But it's to say, man, we got to, you know, take a look at those dynamics and address them if we see some of that. And that's one of the messages of the New Testament is, you know, you will see empire within churches. You will see power. You will see hierarchy and status. We've got to address it. But in empire, we will see empires, because they operate in power, they will be oppressive of any opposition, whether it's ideological or physical or whatever. We will oppress opposition. Empires tend to be highly militaristic, if we're talking national empires now, highly militaristic. But empires are obsessed with defending their way of life. They're obsessed with security. We've got to defend our way of life. Empires become exploitative of those outside of their realm. They're seen as a resource or something to exploit or something to mine, or insider-outsider dynamics. And then empires are driven by fear of others. So you'll see a high level of anxiety in empire. And they will fall by the very things they promise to keep us safe from. Power will always fall. That's, I think, why Jesus said, you know, the Gentiles lord power over one another, not so with you. The Son of Man came to be a servant and a ransom. He didn't come to establish power, because power is a dynamic that will not get us to the new creation. It will always fall. So the day of the Lord is the day when God stands up and allows the power of the empire to fall. And it doesn't necessarily mean like God is coming down with thunderbolts and lightning bolts and taking in the, on themselves. But it's clear that these are the dynamics set in place. Empires will fall and God will allow it to happen. God is, you know, maybe causes it in some cases, but will definitely allow it. And it's seen as God's judgment on empire. So this time in Exodus is the first day, and it becomes an archetype then, right? This is what God does. When God opposes empire, it's the day of the Lord. That's what it is. When empires get their comeuppance, because the other thing is empires always act like they're going to last forever. Like, we've figured it all out. We're going to last forever, right? So when God opposes the day of the Lord, when God opposes empire, that is the day of the Lord. Because they take on this role of deciding for themselves what's right and wrong and self-exaltation and all of that kind of stuff. So what we do need to be aware of, though, is there's a pattern of the day of the Lord. Egypt experienced the day of the Lord. Babylon experienced the day of the Lord. We'll see a surprising nation who experiences the day of the Lord. But then there's an ultimate day of the Lord. So there's these kind of rhyming days of the Lord that's just part of being empire. And then there's an ultimate day of the Lord that's still out there. When God will deal with all the stoicae, all the systems of the world that are set up against God, all of the evil and pride. And we see that in 2 Peter 3 being described in very imaginative language that some people look at and think it's talking about the physical destruction of the world, but it's actually talking about this purifying judgment of God coming in and cleansing the world and judging it. So does that make sense so far? There's a couple of scriptures I want to look at, but I'll just stop. I'm talking a lot. Does that make sense?
Yeah, it makes sense. I had a question for Jason. Jason, so how you explained the day of the Lord earlier in this podcast, how does that fit in now with what Michael has said? You said that it's something we look forward to, something that we're afraid of, something that's coming, something that has been. So how do you feel that fits in with everything Michael has said?
Yeah. Do you know, I think we brought up in the beginning, you know, timekeeping, and how we tend to break out our calendars and predict and crack codes and trace lines to discover when the end will come. And what Michael's just described frustrates that in a number of ways that are really uncomfortable and really encouraging at the same time. So we might think of what he just described as like a spiritual timekeeping. And that is that the past isn't just an isolated moment. The Exodus, the fall of the great city in Genesis 11 of Babylon, you know, these aren't isolated historical events, but an indication of God's judgment in the world, which is ongoing and can be hoped for. To say they're repeatable almost falls short. It's almost like time folds in on itself. So by looking backwards, we're actually looking forwards. When we look at that day of Exodus 15 in that song, we're looking forward as well. But you could call it spiritual timekeeping, but the word spiritual can be unhelpful. I don't know if y'all agree with this or not, and I don't want to confuse people, because right now the word spiritual has found a resurgence among Christians in a way that I think is good. But this isn't like spiritualized timekeeping. And one of the things that Michael talked about that I think is really important is the day of the Lord has to do with the fall of empires within creation. The day of the Lord isn't an end time thing where God just sends people off to hell or off to heaven. But the day of the Lord is a judgment against a misunderstanding of creation, that our lives are embedded in creation. It's resurrection. It's a bringing about within creation the work and will of God. And this is the last thing I'll say. This may come up again later, but the way in the prophets, specifically in the book of Isaiah, in a few moments, this day is called Yom Nakam, the day of vengeance of the Lord. And Isaiah 34 and 35 and 61 are some of the most clear indications of this. But on the one hand, the day of God, the day of vengeance, is something to be produce a lot of anxiety. If it turns out you are enmeshed in the empire and what's good for the empire is good for creation, that's your approach, then it's a warning. God's vengeance will be a destruction that which you may find yourself caught up in. On the other hand, if you are those who experience the brunt and oppression and hostility, violence of the empire, the day of vengeance is one to long for. And it's really interesting, Isaiah's use of this day has all, it's all about creation. It's within creation. In Isaiah 61, the day of the vengeance of the Lord is a preaching of good news to the poor and the marginalized. So this is like almost like a two-sided coin, that when God's day comes, it's one all can know about and kind of keep the right calendar if you choose to. But the sad thing is the empire doesn't listen to look at the clock. It doesn't look at the watch correctly. So it doesn't see that what once happened shall happen again within creation. And I think that's important because we spiritualize this idea. And we just kind of talk about it in terms of like, well, God will judge all sin one day finally, which is perfectly true. But that means then that the day of the Lord is just something to figure out and look for rather than to live now. That the day of the Lord has a, and it wouldn't be brought up in the Bible if it didn't have a lot of importance for how we're living now, how we're interacting now with power in the world. So I think this is a teaching with a really sharp edge, in my opinion, not just something to fear and save people from, but to, I don't know, is live out the right word? I don't know.
Yeah. So instead of trying to figure out the date, figure out how and what it means for our lives today.
There you go. That's what I should have just said it like that.
Oh, no, you explained it perfectly well. And I know, Michael, you wanted to bring up some other scriptures to continue on. But if you want to address anything Jason mentioned.
Yeah, no, I think that was so good and such an important reminder. And thank you for saying that, Jason. And, you know, you asked specifically, Gianna, about Jason's statement. And Jason explained some more there with the idea of it being good news, but also maybe bad news, you know, and it's kind of unclear. I think of a silly example, like let's say you and Reggie, your husband, are bumping in your marriage, right? And you set up some time with the couple that you know, that mentors you guys, that you appreciate, and you're going to get some time with them to get some teaching and direction and help. And you are just convinced that they are going to see it your way. They are going to come in and vindicate you. Right. And you're like, oh, I can't wait for Friday.
Did you get binoculars and watch our last week?
No, that's funny. But you know, it's like, I can't wait for Friday because Reggie's going to get it.
Yes.
Yeah. He is.
I'll be redeemed. My vengeance. Yes.
I will be redeemed and vindicated. Mm-hmm. And then you sit down and they start hearing it out and they go, you know, Gianna, it sounds like actually maybe you are the problem here. And they start, you know, pointing some truths out to you and you go, whoa, wait a minute. This is not how this is supposed to go. And suddenly the day that you were looking forward to has kind of turned in on you. Mm-hmm. And now you're the one being judged. And is that, I know that's a simplification, Jason, but is that a fair way to sort of.
It's like our power is unchecked. And then we assume that this is an indication that the gods or ultimate power is in fact on our side. And it produces a real arrogance. Right. And then lo and behold, God arrives and you're just humbled to dust, right? Like your power is stripped from you. You're shown to be a flimsy, trivial. And it doesn't seem, correct me if I'm wrong, it doesn't seem like God, it's not, and maybe this doesn't need to be said, but it's not that God has excessive anger against people. It's not that God looks at, a corrupt corporation and he just hates all the individuals which inhabit that corporation. But it's a vengeance toward the serpent, which is that power is a manifestation of his failing power, right? Like it's a hostility against those powers which corrupt humanity, because this day is, unfortunately often described in bloody terms. But the irony, I suppose, is the blood ends up being God's blood. But people who are surprised by God's judgment, we shouldn't understand that God hates those people, or God just can't wait to kill those people. Right. I mean,
right.
It's a compassion. It's actually a
loving act of God to judge and deal with what destroys his creation.
Right. And mercy.
And I'll even go and say this, and I want to hear what you guys think about this. I would say that empire, if we're talking in its purest form, Rome, Babylon, Egypt, modern empires, whatever, are very obvious, right? They revel in their power. They revel in their might. They flaunt it. And it's very visible, and it's easy to go, yeah, God, how long? Come and judge that. Man, day of the Lord, come on. Let them fall. But the dynamics of empire that get into smaller places, our hearts, our organizations, our things, I think we become blind to the dynamics of power that operate in our favor. And so when God says, I'm going to deal with power that sets itself up against me and over others, and we're like, woohoo, because we like to see ourselves as the good guy and the little guy, that might come back to bite us if we have engaged in these dynamics.
For our good, right?
To
humble us, that we might detach ourselves from those ridiculous small notions of power.
I see that in 1 Corinthians 11, where Paul is rebuking the church for instilling hierarchy and social status in the communion. And he says, this judgment that I'm bringing on you is actually a good thing, because you're being judged and exposed now rather than on the great day of the Lord. In essence, is what he's saying, like, better to, have the sting now and deal with it. So, but let me jump ahead and look at some of this language. We're not going to look at all of the instances, but in Isaiah 2, verse 6, you, Lord, have abandoned your people, the descendants of Jacob. They are full of superstitions from the east. They practice divination like the Philistines and embrace pagan customs. Their land is full of silver and gold. There's no end to their treasures. Their land is full of horses. There's no end to their chariots. Their land is full of idols. They bow down to the work of their hands. So what their fingers, the work of their hands to what their fingers have made. So people will be brought low and everyone humbled. Do not forgive them. Go into the rocks. Hide in the ground from the fearful presence of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty. The eyes of the arrogant will be humbled and human pride brought low. The Lord alone will be exalted in that day. The Lord Almighty has a day in store for all the proud and lofty, for all that is exalted, and they will be humbled. And he goes on in verse 19 to describe people will flee to the caves and the rocks and the holes in the ground from the fearful presence of the Lord and the splendor of his majesty. When he rises to shake the earth in that day, people will throw away to the moles and bats their idols of silver and idols of gold, which they made to worship. They'll flee to the caverns and the rocks, and on from there it goes when it says he rises and shakes the earth in verse 21. So there's kind of that archetype, that picture of the day when God is going to deal with this stuff. Now look at another example in Isaiah 13. And now we have the day, and notice at the beginning of chapter 13, the NIV provided headline, there is a prophecy against Babylon. So this is what God is saying to Babylon, the empire. And in verse 6, it says, wail, for the day of the Lord is near. It will come like destruction from the Almighty. Because of this, all hands will go limp. Every heart will melt with fear. Terror will seize them. Pain and anguish will grip them. They will writhe like a woman in labor. They will look aghast at each other, their faces aflame. See, the day of the Lord is coming, a cruel day, with wrath and fierce anger. And I don't think it's saying that God is cruel, but when God allows empire to get a taste of its own medicine, it's a cruel day. All the things that empire did to others and said they could protect their own from is now going to be poured out on them. And it says it will make the land desolate and destroy sinners within it. This, now notice the language here. The stars of heavens and their constellations will not show their light. The rising sun will be darkened, and the moon will not give its light. I will punish the world for its evil, the wicked for their sins. I will put an end to the arrogance of the haughty and will humble the pride of the ruthless. And in verse 19, Babylon, the jewel of kingdoms, the pride and the glory of the Babylonians will be overthrown by God like Sodom and Gomorrah. So again, we have the pattern that you see in each of these, and we're not going to break it down in each one, but you can go back and find these patterns of God judging self-exalting empires, showing himself to be king, and liberating those who have been impressed by the empire and dynamics of empire using that cosmic imagery. Earthquakes, moons, sun, stars, that sort of language.
And that's, and I want to just draw special attention to the use of creation being undone. That's how the poet describes God's judgment. Again, in Isaiah 34, Edom becomes like a siphon, so to speak, for the nations, and Bozrah's capital, all its streams are turned into tar. All of its inhabitants vanish, and the place is called a no place. And all of the new inhabitants which occupy this once thriving city are owls and jackals and goat demons, and it's a place of desolation. Whereas on the next chapter, it describes Zion, and it's there the day of vengeance creates hills exploding with color and flowers and waters being broken out in the desert and the deaf hearing and the lame leaping. So you have this two sides of one coin, so to speak, where creation, God's judgment undoes that which undoes creation. And on the other side, he remakes what has been undone by the thing which was undoing creation. I know that was a ridiculous way to put it, but like the idea that judgment is described as creation kind of coming undone. Think all the way back to the flood story, right? We're brought in Genesis 6 back to Genesis 1 verse 2, a wild and waste world. But the implication, I think, is violence, hostility, selfishness, greed, lust for power, those things are an undoing of God's creation. So it's like we're being given a set of glasses through which to look at our even our personal sin as being co-opted by this power structure of like our sin is not just a breaking of rules so much as an undoing of creation. The nations which imagine that they have ultimate power are not building up God's world. They're tearing it down. But they think they're building it up. Their strong economies are not a sign of God's pleasure or that they've cracked the code in the world. It's a sign that they've actually are undoing creation in their selfishness. So it's like almost
they created a parody of creation, right?
Exactly. Yes, yes. So God, the only way you can describe what God shall do against that is to undo it for the sake of creation. God lets their deterioration happen. It's like he allows it. It's like, okay, it's same with Egypt, right? When the frogs are flying out of the rivers and things are turning to blood and there's no order. It's like God removes order and brings creation upon the thing which is undoing creation. He unleashes it against itself. And I think it's a really helpful way to understand the destructive nature of sin and, you know, these, you know, empire, right?
I think that is a really awesome way to describe it. Just like undoing things. It makes me think of when in the Bible, it's talking about giving you a new heart. Like, I'm going to remove this heart of stone and give you something new, like something that's actually living, even though you thought you had something in place that was working. I'm going to take that out and give you what actually works here.
And it's so surprising and painful.
Yeah.
Right?
Yeah, exactly.
There's that story in The Great Divorce. I don't know if you're familiar with it, but it's basically this being in heaven is terrified and angels trying to help him out because he has this little lizard on his shoulder that whispers these lies into his ears. And it makes this individual nuts. You know, he's listening to this lizard speak lies into his ear. And the angel says, I can help you with that. But the angel is burning. So every time he tries to go and remove this lizard from this individual's shoulders, the guy screams. He's like, no, leave it. You know, he's like, I can take care of that thing in one instant if you allow me to, but it's going to hurt for like a second and then you'll be free. And I think that's kind of the experience. We don't want that burning pain. It feels like we're losing so much to have that serpent taken off of our shoulder. And that's why empires don't listen to God. That's why I think it'd be almost impossible to be a politician and be a disciple of Jesus Christ, because the pain, the losses we would have to take to be righteous and just are too much for empires to stomach. And so they just reject God's ways. But find ways to dance. We all of us find ways to dance around it and make it look like, no, we're still seeking God's will. But really, we're caught up in a total other.
Yeah, I love that, Jason. And, you know, God will always challenge empire. And we see, here's another example in Joel 2. It says, blow the trumpet in Zion, sound the alarm on my holy hill. Let all who live in the land tremble, for the day of the Lord is coming. It's close at hand. A day of darkness and gloom, a day of clouds and blackness, like dawn spreading across the mountains, a large and mighty army comes, such as never was in ancient times, nor ever will be in ages to come. Before them, fire devours. Behind them, a flame blazes. Before them, the land is like the Garden of Eden. Behind them, a desert waste. So there's that imagery of creation being undone, right? Nothing escapes them. Now, it's interesting because what happens, as I said, God opposes when empires in Babylon, God, it will crumble. God will oppose it. When empire sets itself up in Egypt, God will oppose it. But God will also, and you start to get these hints in scripture, God will challenge empire when Israel itself becomes empire. And that's where, wow, is the day of the Lord a good thing or is it a bad thing? Go ahead, Jason. You were going to say
no, something. No. I'm marveling at what you're saying.
Malachi 3, verse 1. I will send my messenger who will prepare the way before me. Then suddenly the Lord you are seeking will come to his temple. The messenger of the covenant whom you desire will come, says the Lord Almighty. But who can endure the day of his coming? We see all this language that we just saw in Revelation 6. Who can stand when he appears? For he will be like a refiner's fire or a launderer's soap. He will sit as a refiner and a purifier of silver. He will purify the Levites and refine them like gold and silver. So the day of the Lord's coming to Israel. Then the Lord will have men who will bring offerings in righteousness, and the offerings of Judah and Jerusalem will be acceptable to the Lord, as in days gone by, as in former years. So I will come to put you on trial. I will be quick to testify against sorcerers, adulterers, and perjurers, against those who defraud laborers of their wages, who oppress the widows and the fatherless, and deprive the foreigners among you of justice. But do not fear me, says the Lord Almighty. So here's that day of the Lord language. Jesus appeals to that in Matthew 24 when he's asked about the destruction of the temple and when all that's going to go down. He starts using day of the Lord language. And of course, we see it. That's what John depicts in Revelation 6. And let me just go back to that really quickly. He says, again, we see this pattern of language, the cosmic language describing God's judgment against empire and the dynamics of empire, showing himself to be king and liberating those who have been oppressed. And he says, there was a great earthquake, the sun turned black, using, by the way, that cosmic type imagery. There's a great earthquake, the sun turned black like sackcloth made of goat hair, the whole moon turned blood red, and the stars in the sky fell to the earth. This is not astronomy. This is depicting that uncreation happening as God allows empire to get a taste of its own medicine. The heavens receded like a scroll being rolled up, and every mountain and island was removed from its place. The kings of the earth, the princes, the generals, the rich, the mighty, everyone else, both slave and free, hid in caves among the rocks of the mountains. We saw that language that we just read in the prophets. They called to the mountains and the rocks, fall on us and hide us from the face of him who sits on the throne and from the wrath of the Lamb. And this is interesting. I'll kind of end here. For the great day of their wrath has come, and who can withstand it? Who can stand at the great day of the Lord? And we won't get into this really heavily today, but the very next chapter, he looks and he sees those who can stand. He sees 144,000, and it follows that pattern we've talked about before of hearing what we expect will be and then seeing what it really is. So I hear that there's a lion. That's what I'm expecting. But the reality is the lion is coming as a lamb. It's the way of the cross. So I'm hearing 144,000 from all the tribes of Israel. That's what was always expected. Israel will be exalted on the day of the Lord. But when I looked, there was a great multitude that no one could count from every nation, tribe, people, and language standing before the throne and the Lamb. They are the ones who can stand the day of the Lord. And then ultimately in Revelation 19, we see the final day of the Lord, when God will come and deal with all that sets itself up against his good and beautiful creation. And I'm going to stop there.
So good. So good. It makes me want to look forward to, like, oh, let's continue. Let's go on to the next thing. Because, you know, I always want to look forward to when God gives us the thing to look forward to. Because at this point, you know, it feels like, who can stand it? Okay, right. Well, I don't know. Like, should I just stop here? Should I just stop trying? But I think that's what's always great about God. It's like, you know, for those that are following, like, there is nothing to fear. There will be great magnitude of us here. And he shows us how. And helps us and gives us the tools, and we have the Holy Spirit. We have an advocate. We have all these things. So exciting stuff. Jason, any last words from you?
Well, I think I was just thinking about how as the people of God, We need to work hard to be paying attention to what, you know, what God is doing, what God loves. You know, the Beatitude, which says, blessed are those who hunger and thirst for righteousness. Like, that's an acquired taste. That's something to really, you know, of course you could say, yeah, I hunger and thirst for righteousness, but when God acts to bring about his righteousness, sometimes it stings and sometimes we don't listen. And so I think it's hard to pay attention and learn to thank God when he challenges these tendencies within us or within our institutions. You know, for us in the International Churches of Christ, we experienced a global crisis back in 2003. And I think, you know, of course, it's a controversial topic because it's filled with pain for so many people in the Churches of Christ. But, you know, I look at some of God's judgment on some of our ways that we're not lining up. And it wasn't a sign that God was displeased with our churches. What I mean to say is God doesn't hate and want to tear down, but he's helping. He's working within us to teach us how to be faithful, how to seek him, how to be humble. And the challenge is when God acts like that, we don't take it as mercy and grace. We struggle and, you know, we can so easily fail to listen to what God is doing. And I think it's a challenge to learn to celebrate when God acts because he's delivering us from those notions of power. And I see it even in my own life. I mean, if we were to distill this down to the individual life, like God is on a regular basis. And I think I'm becoming more and more aware of it as I get older. He's challenging, like Michael said, what I think is the case and then what is actually the case. You know, what I think is important and then what is actually important. And as I discover those things with the wonderful help of God, it's difficult. And I think I'm learning to thank God when he challenges me, not because it's awesome to be challenged, but because he's helping me, he's delivering me, he's rescuing me from this dominion of evil and deception. So I find it a high calling. This day of the Lord really, for me, makes me think even as churches, we need to be really aware when God acts to confront us, that's a sign of his love, not hostility toward us. Anyways, yeah.
Good stuff. I have a lot to say, but we are all out of time this week. We will have much more to say next week. Thanks for sticking with us. Communicate with us via email or on Facebook. We'll catch you guys next week.